After the Buddha died 2,500 years ago, the monk, they gather all the closest monk who had spent most time with the Buddha and who had received most of his teaching. There were 500 of them. They all gathered and everyone recited what they had heard from the Buddha, not to lose any of his teaching. They thought it would be good that they all gathered and could check what the Buddha had told. Everyone started by saying, "Thus I have heard, once the Buddha was staying in this garden or in this place, and then he said that." That has been collected and gathered in the collection of texts called the Tripitaka, the triple baskets, which amount to many texts. But when one, or if one were to check, not so many deal really with the practice of meditation, and not so many texts will be very precise and explain what is to be practiced. Many texts about small anecdotes and stories, giving some moral instructions, giving some information, but not so many texts being very precise about the practice of meditation. One is a strong exception, the Satipatthana Sutra, where the Buddha seems only to deal at this time with the practice of meditation. Very precisely, he gives us all the instruction how to practice to contact reality, and he expressed that in a very clear way. He said, "Bhikkhu," which means monk, "this is a direct path for the purification of being, for the realization of nirvana, namely the four foundations of mindfulness," which is the Satipatthana Sutra. So he said that is the direct path for the attainment of nirvana. Just that, the practice of the four foundations of mindfulness. What are those four? They are mindfulness of body, that we've been practicing, being aware of the sitting position, being aware of the breath, being aware also of our walking, our movement during the day. There are many other aspects of this foundation of mindfulness, but that's what we'll start to practice. The second one, the second foundation of mindfulness, is mindfulness of feeling. With any experience, there may be some happy feeling, some unhappy feeling, or some neutral feeling. Being aware of that is also a foundation of mindfulness. Third foundation is the mindfulness of the mind, knowing the mind as a mind. And it is explained also by the Buddha that a meditator, when his mind or her mind is affected by lust, he or she knows the mind being affected by lust, and give many other attitude of mind of which the meditator must be mindful. That the third foundation of mindfulness. And the fourth one, which is usually called mindfulness of the Dhamma, a term which is very vast and vague, translated sometimes as mind object, but not so accurately. In this fourth foundation of mindfulness, there are many aspects of which the meditator may be mindful. The Four Noble Truths, different qualities of the mind leading to enlightenment or awakening, and one aspect which is very important in the practice is the mindfulness of the five hindrances. It is very important to see that those obstacles, hindrances, they are foundation of mindfulness and they are direct path leading to nirvana. The obstacles, when they are practiced with mindfulness, they become the foundation for the attainment of awakening, of nirvana, not for leading us astray. The difference between obstacle, bringing problem, being hindrances to the reaching of ultimate freedom, is whether there is mindfulness or not. When there is mindfulness, those same hindrances will lead to awakening. When there is no mindfulness, then they lead to much problem and much suffering. I will speak tonight about those hindrances, foundation of mindfulness. The Indian law of classification, so they speak of five, but certainly there may be many other aspects of hindrances. In one text in the Dhammapada, the Buddha says something like that. Anyway, translation sometimes differs, so even if I just recite that however I remember, it may be not exactly how it is stated, but he says that the warrior who 1,000 times defeat 1,000 enemy on a battlefield is very glorious. But the one who defeats his own mind is even more glorious. The one who conquers his own mind is even more glorious. Today I said in a group interview that our meditation is not a battlefield. And now I get with a quotation from the Buddha where he seems to make an analogy with a battlefield. I will have to find some solution with that. And that's a problem with example. They often fit in some way and some other they bring also some difficulties. Well, let's see. So this quotation amount of saying, glorious is the one who conquers his own mind or her own mind, which is what the meditation is about. No glorious, I mean, who cares about being glorious? What does it mean, you know? What, would one have one's name in the newspaper with one's picture, you know, very well known? Of course, that's not what it means there, glorious here. Glorious, the one who conquers his or her own mind, will mean free. Completely free will be the one who conquers his own mind. Now, what is to conquer one's mind? Is it to defeat? To defeat. And what is to defeat one's mind? What is left if one is defeating one's mind? Who will enjoy the victory? The nature of the mind is described and explained as being, by its own nature, very clear and knowing. It's a quality of ourself, being very clear and knowing, vast and knowing. It means that by nature the mind has no color, no shape, no dimension, but it just knows, just a quality of knowing. That's just a quality of mind, and that cannot be defeated, neither can it be conquered. Now what may arise, sometimes we don't experience our mind in this way, very seldom or maybe never. What is arising sometimes is different clouds in this sky of the mind, like doubts, desire, confusion, anger, hatred. Many aspects are appearing, clouding the mind. those may be seen as enemies, not the mind. We could say desire, anger, doubts, whatsoever. Now if we would call them enemies to be defeated, we are bringing within ourselves a battlefield. Then maybe is not what is meant. Maybe something different is meant by conquer. We could imagine rather taking another example about land. Conquering here means a land one has lost and get this land. Within ourselves, it means that if one try or if one is used to push away part of oneself, maybe desire, aversion, doubt, one is in the habit of pushing them away, pushing part of oneself away, then to conquer one's mind is meant to win them back, to include them within oneself. With the power of mindfulness, that they may lose their power of confusion. Doesn't mean that one is going to suppress, subdue, fight against those hindrances. Fighting is what one is trying most of the time, pushing them away. I don't want desire or anger. Distraction, fighting them, to defeat them, that is not possible. Foundation of mindfulness shows us and teaches us that is not the way. The way is by being mindful of them, and this mindfulness of those hindrances will clear away their confusion, but not the quality of being oneself. Not splitting us apart. We'll see that step by step. The first hindrance, which is usually named, is desire, which arises in the mind. It arises due to some certain condition, certain situation. Desire is necessarily and always confused about the quality of its object. There is an over-evaluation of the quality of its object. If there is no over-evaluation, then it is not called desire. You can call it something different. But in the definition of desire, there is over-evaluation of the quality of its object. And the mind clings to that object seen through this over-evaluation to find satisfaction. If the mind needs satisfaction, it means that the mind is lacking satisfaction. When everything is very fine, when it's completely satisfied, there is no... At this time, there is no need to look for satisfaction. Which means that desire is always arising from a sense of incompleteness. Something is lacking, then one will look for completeness, one will look for satisfaction in different fields, turning the mind to different situations or different objects. And they may be small object, even small satisfaction, but certainly deeply within oneself, one is looking for a complete satisfaction, for a sense of completeness, not for small happiness or small completeness. In a sense, our desires are always based on the desire, on a very great and big desire for completeness. even when we turn the mind towards small object or small situation. Desire always perpetuates a sense of duration. One never desires what one has. One always desires something which is not here. I may imagine there is desire, I bring a plate of food with in front of myself. And if there is desire, it's desire to eat it, not to have it. I have it already. And when I eat it, then there is satisfaction, hopefully. If there is desire, it's for more, or maybe there is a fear that I will have not enough. But desire is always within time and duration, which means that when there is a sense of duration, there is a concept. Not so much problem with duration and with desire, just that it always brings frustration. There is no way that we can collapse the time. There is no way that we can do something about the future. We need to wait till this time will be here. And with the desire, the working of desire, always the sense of something is lacking, because it is of course not present. When it's present, there is no more desire. With desire, actually we bring the situation for frustration. I remember once, the first time when I came back from India, I was received by a psychoanalyst and her husband. And he asked me what I learned in India, and I was speaking about meditation and about the absence of desire. And he said, oh no, that's not possible. How boring is a life without desire? I would not like that. Imagine a life without desire, going to be completely boring. I understand that may be our first reaction. But if we see a bit more carefully within desire, if desire will be not such a problem, well, to make it stop. And when we look for satisfaction, we want the desire to stop. Then say, no, I just keep that for later, otherwise the desire will go, so I just keep the objective later. It may be so strong within oneself that one really need to make it stop. And how we usually try to stop it? By getting satisfaction just for a short time, then another desire will happen. So if the desire itself was something pleasing, then we'll just always keep something for the future that at least we can keep on desiring. I don't think that's what we are doing usually. Power of desire can be very strong, pushing people to do very dramatic action just for satisfaction of desire, just to stop this intense tension within oneself. I need to stop it. Desire in itself is painful, and the consequence may be painful also, and it perpetuates confusion because the sense of duration keep building up concepts, and also the over-evaluation of the quality of the object. So what to do when it comes in our meditation? I'm sitting here peacefully, and then suddenly there are some images, concept or thought which rise desire within me. You know, I want that, I like to get that. Then I mean, pushing it away, you know. Not that later, now I am meditating, I want to come back to my breath or just to be seated here, and then a little while after it come back and with much power. So what to do? And pushing it away, I try to push it away. No desire, it's not a peaceful meditation with desire, and desire is not what should happen in meditation. If we could push desire away like that, it would mean that desire is something outside of ourselves. Like I may have a hat, you know, take my hat, put my hat there and put it back. You know, can we do the same with desire? Put it in my pocket or somewhere and then I take it later. It's a state of mind. State of mind which is not separate from myself. Then if I try to push it away, to get rid of it, what does it mean? It means that I'm trying to get rid of a part of myself. Then I come to a meditation course, hoping for completeness, and then I just sit there, and I start to cut myself into fragments. I want to get rid of this state of mind, which is desire. It's a hopeless task. In the foundation of mindfulness, the Buddha taught the means of integrating that, this land which is my or which is me, in a general sense, I'm not pushing it away, giving it away, but in the contrary, including within my own being. Through the power of mindfulness, being aware of it, desire is arising, I feel it, I know it, not pushing it away. Then through the power of mindfulness, a balanced way of receiving this experience may arise. When it's received with a balanced mind, the power of confusion, of frustration, then is going away. Then desire is not anymore a problem, but is a foundation of mindfulness and also a path to nirvana. Pushing it away is not the path to nirvana. It is a path to mental disorder. I think it's very interesting that the Buddha has included that in the foundation of mindfulness. No part of our experience has to be left outside. So desire is arising in our meditation, we can recognize it. The sutra says very clearly, speak about the monks, but hopefully it applies also to lay people, that when a bhikkhu, when the mind of a bhikkhu is affected by desire, he knows his mind is affected by desire. It doesn't say any other thing, it doesn't say, then he starts to worry about and run to another monk or to his teacher and say, what should I do? You know, they are desiring me, and or start to fight with it. It just says, he knows his mind is affected by desire. It has the quality of the yes answer of the Buddha last night I was speaking about. You know. Is it true that some people say yes? And the mind is there, affected, clouded by desire? Yes. Doesn't mean that one would try to perpetuate it. One would see the movement of desire. Maybe one would recognize also the object which is increasing this desire. And recognize, which is here in our meditation, a thought, mental image arising there. Recognizing this mental image or this thought, as a mental image, and the fascination of it, will go away, and the desire will lose some of its power. Imagine we are sitting in this hall with closed eyes. If I would be filming with a video, nothing is happening. People are seated. But if there would be a video in the mind of each one of us, so many things are happening in this room. Actually, nothing is happening. Yet maybe we see that, oh, this thing and I will do that, and there's a scenario happening already. Of course it's not true. It's just concept and mental image arising, and I just believe them, till finally I said, well, what's happening? I come back to my sense or myself, to awareness, a way to deal also with desire is not to perpetuate them by holding on to all those mental images and all that we are bringing into our mind, recognizing. I was telling today to the group I had that Indian teacher said, the thought of my mother is not my mother. And that's quite important, that any thought we are having are not the object that we are thinking about. And a thought is very boring, actually. Has no taste, no form, no color, doesn't bring anything. If we had the thought here of a glass of water, it will never allow us to drink. Yet, most of the time we are fascinated because we take the thought for the object they are intending. And then we just confuse, we are confused between the thought and the object. And then we get fascinated. Recognizing what's happening there, increasing our desire, may help us to get back in the situation. We don't need to fight against those images or the thought, recognizing them for what they are. Just to recognize them. Recognize this state of mind, which is desire. Just to know, oh no, there is desire. Just that much. That's a way to to deal with this hindrance, and that's also the way to practice this foundation of mindfulness. The second aspect is aversion. And aversion is always mistaken with respect to its object, due to an over-evaluation of its bad characteristic. If there is not this over-evaluation, then one would not call that aversion. Those hindrances always have an element of confusion. There is an over-evaluation of the bad aspect of an object or person or situation, then one cannot bear the situation, the object, or the other person. As a state of mind of not being able to bear, or to want to harm, to want to push it away, to want to destroy. That also a state of mind that one cannot defeat, suppress, or fight against it. In the same way, one need to be mindful, to be aware of that aspect when it arises in the mind, because it is a state of mind. And we can't get rid of that without getting rid of ourselves. So it's just a state of mind to be recognized and to see how this starts to influence ourselves, influence the mind itself. Anger is arising, aversion is arising, suddenly I just get up and go and break a cup. I was upset. Then this is aversion just leading me to this action. Action can be much more, of course, serious than just breaking a cup. But that's the same play of aversion. Because one doesn't want to bear or to stand a person, a situation, an object. Then one is defeated. If one would take back the example of the warrior, one is defeated by a small situation. I'm sometimes guiding people in Tibet and north of India, and it's very interesting to see how people react when we come after many hours of driving, being very tired, and we come in a very bad hotel where nothing is working. Then to see how the people react. Then some people, it seems that they always get the worst room and the worst bathroom. Nothing is working. You know, they come and say, well, can I change of my room because this doesn't work? Nothing is working there. And you wonder why it's always the same people who just always find the worst room. And then they come to dinner and you see that they complain because the soup is not very warm. And, you know, then situation is never good enough. Then they need to, not to adjust to the situation, but to adjust the situation to themselves. That is a huge task, of course, because when you are in the Himalayas, it's very difficult to adjust the mountain to the you are fit with your body, and then you say, you know, it's very nice here, but it's a bit too high. I have a hard time. Nothing you can do. although it's very gross, it's amazing how people want to change the situation. I had amazing examples, I should say. Once I went in southern Nepal to hunt tiger, an elephant. Not hunting with gun, you know, but with a camera. And I had a couple of people, they went very often to Kenya. Then they had seen lions and tigers, so they say, or lions, I think, they say, well, after the first evening when we were riding elephant for 2 hours, not seeing any tigers, they say, why don't they have talkie-walkie and why don't they have jeep to see where the tigers so we can see them? And the man said, why don't they add tigers? This place is big enough, they could put more tigers. And, you know, I was really... It was a very, very difficult evening for me because I was eating with them and start to really... It was the first day of our tour. I had to spend 2 weeks with them and I wonder how I will be able to last for 2 weeks. If the demon was so absurd. Then we spent 2 days going morning and evening to hunt the tigers. I mean, all the elephant, they try to see the track of a tiger and then they just gather in a circle and they go in a narrow way. And if the tiger is in the center, then you can see the tiger, suddenly jumps away. I think the last evening, luckily, they saw the tigers and they were happy, and then they forget about the talkie-walkie and the jeep and putting more tigers. I think they were glad that at least they had to spend 2 days to see those tigers. But it was amazing how the demand of adjusting this national park in Nepal to the one in Kenya, you know, just changing. There was no road. I don't see what you could do with it. That there are two types of people when they go around in the world. Some who try to cover the whole earth with leather so that their feet can be not harmed. And some who just put a small piece of leather under their feet and then they can go wherever they want. And there are many situations we can see. We come here in a retreat and then we go in our room. We say, oh, that's too small. Oh, that's too big. You know. Oh, I wonder if this... Oh, the road is there and then I would hear the cars. You know, there are many, many ways. Either we adjust to the situation or we want to adjust the situation. You know. I wish the dinner will be half an hour earlier or half an hour later because, you know, I don't feel so hungry yet. 5:15 is much too early. Usually I eat at 7 home. Then all this reaction towards the situation, just not being able to adjust. One wants to just adjust always. The situation should change that we don't need to do anything within ourselves. So many examples. And we may laugh, each one of us, but if there was a small camera following us, I think we'll be surprised to see how often we would like to adjust the world and not ourselves. In the example of the warrior, I think that is speaking very much than not to be defeated by your situation. I remember once guiding a tour in north of India, in Spiti actually, we had to leave the country through a high pass and it was covered by snow, so we could not go. We had to change our road and we decided to come back through the same road. We drove quite a long time and came to a small village at night. It was dark and I had seen some hotel on the way, so I thought maybe we'd find some room to sleep. But when we reached there, there was a wedding party and all the hotels, all the rooms were full. Then I was with 10 people. I had to find some place to, you know, make them sleep. Then with the bus driver, we went to the police station asking if maybe there was some other hotel we did not know. I said, no, they are all full. There is this big, big wedding party. But you can sleep in the police station. Imagine a police station in India, in the Himalayas. I mean, not very comfortable. And I told the people, I said, well, we can't sleep in the police station. And they say, fine. They say, fine. There was no expectation that we live beautiful rooms. They knew we had changed the road. We could not go through a covered snow pass. They agreed. They were not defeated by the police station. Some other have been defeated by much smaller things. In our meditation, we just sit there, and there are sometimes thoughts, images arising which bring aversion because of past experience, because of people, because of situation. Then aversion. I'm experiencing some pain, then aversion is arising. Oh, again pain. Then one wants to push it away. There's a reaction of aversion there. So what to do? Again, it's a foundation of mindfulness, just being aware. To quote the Buddha again, he said, when the mind of a bhikkhu is affected by aversion, he knows his mind is affected by aversion. It's fantastic how it is phrased. It doesn't say something very complicated. He knows his mind is afflicted by aversion. No way to get rid of it, no way to fight it, he just knows. So when aversion is arising, one should know. If there is pain and there is aversion arising, one is not aware of aversion, then one very sincerely try to contact the pain, but there is aversion. Then one is not in contact with the situation. However, one may try very sincerely to be in contact with the situation because one is not knowing that aversion is there. At this time it's very important knowing there is aversion. There is aversion, then one contact that, one may come back to the pain and maybe there will be some different way of relating to the pain. Knowing that it is with aversion, and aversion may change because all those hindrances, they are not blocked, not changing, they just change every instant. Get more intense, less intense, or disappear, or arise. That they won't stay. So the awareness of them will also bring into the processes some element of change. Maybe intensification, or maybe lessening of it. Working with aversion, then just being aware and know that there is aversion. Not trying to push it away again, it will be. Aversion is a state of mind. If we want to get rid of that, it means we get rid of ourselves or part of ourselves. And that's not possible. There's no way. Then just being aware of it. And the awareness will bring, or the mindfulness of it will bring some balance in the mind which will allow aversion to be here and not to be confusing us. When there is mindfulness, aversion is never going to bring us to the kitchen and break this cup or to do something much more serious. There will be a balancing of mind and then we are not going to be ruled by desire, aversion or other hindrances. Just being aware also of thoughts and concepts if they do increase the aversion. Sometimes one remembers a situation which has happened and then just bring more and more memories and then the aversion is coming stronger or anger is coming stronger. And one sees that one is just bringing. When, again, I said I was speaking about this small video, if they were in the room and seeing just everybody is sitting there, it's amazing sometimes that you come to a sitting, or I come to a sitting, and then in the middle I find I am upset and angry. But nothing has happened. I did not receive any phone and did not read any letters. Suddenly I'm angry. I am very upset. Just because my thought brought some kind of scenario which just make me upset. Nobody has come in the room, nothing. So it's amazing how we just build up situation through memories, concepts, and how we can trouble ourselves with so many different scenarios. Just being aware of aversion and how we are sometimes increasing aversion, just staying with a balanced mind, not pushing it away. Now the third one, the third hindrance I like to speak about is doubt. Doubt is very interesting. It's always connected, of course, with thinking. And one may have doubt about many things, in a retreat about the technique, the practice. Doesn't work, doesn't make sense. It's much better to do yoga, to do tai chi, to do chanting, whatsoever is much better. Then one has doubt about the technique. Or doubt about the usefulness, you know. Anyway, what is used to be awakened or free and all those kind of very, very abstract terms, you know, who is free anyway in this room and even the teachers and even in India, I've been there, I really wonder who is free, you know, they all practice for so many years, yeah, doesn't change anything. So doubt about the usefulness, doubt about oneself, I think that's fantastic, really nice, some people can do, they are very quiet and they do it and they walk so slowly, but I can't do it, you know, it's not for me, it's too difficult, it's not the proper time for me, you know, just I think this week is not the best week for me to practice. Next time will be much better. Maybe a summer retreat will be better, or not in Jerusalem, maybe somewhere in the south, or at some other place. So many doubts. Now about the teacher, you know, who are they? You know, what do they know? They come here and speak, and they hardly speak English, you know. And then explaining all those things, there is some doubts. You know, why? I really, you know, that's fine, but I can't trust them. And many ways of doubting, and mixture of, you know, all of them and part of one and the other. And doubt is actually very powerful, because when one starts to doubt, one is out of the practice, one is completely out of the game. When there is desire, when there is aversion, one may still be practicing, but doubt, one just is out. First, when he's lost in thinking. And when he's thinking, one doesn't experience a practice. Then thinking is useless about. Thinking about the practice is useless. So one is doubting a lot, and that makes the practice useless. So one is correct while doubting a lot that it is useless, because doubts make it useless. And that is correct. Doubting about the practice, and also it has a sense of supermarket wisdom, you know, it's kind of wisdom in disguise, you know. Well, you know, I check, that's not good, you know. And all those people, they look a little bit, I think they're a bit disturbed, mentally disturbed, you know. They don't look. And then this sense of, I know, I judge. I'm not going to let me draw into this kind of, you know, this kind of people or this kind of association or cult, you know, then it's kind of an element of wisdom. One believes wisdom. I'm smart. I'm judging. I don't let myself drawn into any kind of silly things. An element of wisdom in disguise. And to doubt and to evaluate the practice, it's not possible, because a practice is something one experiences, not conceptually, but directly. And doubt is just to be lost in concept. So when the doubting mind wants to judge the practice, it can't, because it's just not at the right place. I'll give you a silly example. Imagine that you want to evaluate a meal, a good meal. And then you take the recipe on a piece of paper and you smell it. Doesn't smell so good, you know. Taste it. Doesn't taste so good. It's not warm, you know. It has no temperature, you know. This meal is not so good. And you just are with the recipe, not with the meal. Doubting about the practice is like that. It's just taking the recipe and believe that one can evaluate the quality of this meal or of this dish through tasting the recipe. Doesn't help so much. Now it's difficult to deal with doubt. And of course there are doubts which are useful. It's not that when a doubt is arising, then when we just push it away and say it's just concept, then just to believe whatever he said, that's not, I think, what is meant. Some people had some doubts. Said, last night I thought maybe there is no morality. And the doubt is arising. What is he saying? You know? Is it proper? Is it really what he meant? There is no morality? I think that's a proper doubt. If something is not clear, I don't express myself always very clearly, and I understand people wonder what will mean, no doubt. Just discarding that. That won't be smart, that won't be useful. So some doubts are useful. Some doubts have to be answered. But one can see very well when a doubt is arising due to some thing which is not clear, not understood, or just a doubt arising which keep us away from the practice. Doubt is just a way of avoiding to be in contact. Maybe I come here and I am sitting. Maybe there is some deep emotion within myself, some sadness. Then it's just sitting and maybe it's very slightly arising. But I may not like to be in touch with that. Then I start to doubt. Start to tell many stories. Then this energy which is needed for doubting, for all those thoughts, that will prevent me to be in touch with the situation. So when doubts is arising or are arising, they prevent us from being in contact with the situation. Sometimes it's done to avoid a situation which is painful. Sometimes it is just done out of habit. One need really to be sure that that's proper what I'm doing, that's clear, and that will be helpful. Then sometimes one needs some clarification, and I understand that very clearly. But one has to see how the doubts are arising, from which place, how do they come, and if they need a proper answer, or if they need sometimes just to be not giving energy anymore and come back to some more simple experience of our sitting and of our meditation. Again, the Buddha says in his teaching on the four foundations of mindfulness, when the mind of a bhikkhu is affected by doubt, he knows my mind is affected by doubt. He did not say judge himself or condemn himself. Neither did he say he run to the Buddha and ask a question. He just knows his mind being affected by doubt. Now some other state of mind may arise, restlessness. One comes to a meditation and then there is a lot of agitation, thinking. One feels so many thoughts are arising. It's amazing the amount of thought which may arise within a short amount of time in our meditation. That may come from different reasons, sometimes from a unbalance of mind. Sometimes there is too much effort is made. You know, I'm trying to be here, you know, really meditating. And this amount of effort brings some energy which gives rise to agitation. And this time may be useful to relax and not to have too much expectation. I want a good meditation. I want a meditation without thinking, very peaceful. Just to relax into what's happening. Of course, not fighting the agitation or restlessness. Again, the Buddha said the monk knows his mind being affected by restlessness. That one aspect. Another aspect to deal with restlessness may also, if one has opened a little bit the field of one's experience, then to make it a bit more narrow. If one would be open to all the bodily sensation, maybe to hearing sounds, maybe to the different feelings, then too much restlessness, one may in this situation just come back to something much more simple, be just the rising and falling of the abdomen or the touching point with the cushion and the knees, just coming back to something simple. Maybe the mind will get a new balance. Again, not fighting restlessness, because it's a state of mind and we cannot get rid of ourselves, and it's not the aim of meditation. Restlessness may also arise from a lot of thinking, and sometimes just to recognize thoughts as thoughts may also give less power to the thought to fascinate us and bring so much agitation. Again, the thought of my mother is not my mother, and of course any thought is not the object about which one is thinking. And that may be useful sometimes, to recognize that. The moment one sees something is fascinating or disturbing us, like with anger or with desire, and one recognizes it as just a thought or as just a mental image, there is a letting go of the grasping, of the clinging, of the aversion, and one can see how much freedom is there, just in not cheating oneself anymore. So sometimes recognizing thoughts just as thoughts, taking a few points of concentration and getting to a more simple practice for the time being. Then one may open later on again to experience the whole body and maybe also hearing sounds and feelings. The last one of the hindrance is sloth and torpor. When one may come to a sitting and it's very difficult to have enough energy, one feels the mind is completely clouded, has no energy, does not perceive anything. One doesn't feel really even where one is seated, one doesn't feel the movement of the abdomen. There is a lack of energy. Then one feels it's difficult, either one makes sometimes try to overdo, to over make some effort, and that does not work. I try to bring more energy, but it's forcefully, and that does not bring a balance of mind. Like all the hindrances, the first attitude is to be mindful of it. Just to know the mind being affected by sloth and torpor. To experience it. It's not just a knowing that you write in your notebook there, you know, there is sloth and torpor, and then that's it, I know. Being in contact with it, that's what it means, knowing it's being in contact, in touch with it, feeling, experiencing agitation, or here sloth and torpor, experiencing it. And sometimes within the experience of sloth and torpor, one may see that there can be some clarity, which is very strange. It seems that there is dullness, yet this dullness finally does not cover completely the clarity of mind. Just being interested into what really is sloth and torpor or dullness, experiencing it within oneself. One aspect, the main aspect to deal with it. And one may also try to be more precise, again get to a few points of awareness, like the touching with the cushion or the pillow or maybe the knees. Very simple, starting maybe trying to be very precise at the beginning of the breath, just when it starts, just to choose some element, not a too vast or complex task, getting narrow in the task, and try to be very attentive to that. Or if it is a walking, then walk faster, or sometimes even slower. See which speed corresponds to the state of mind. Sometimes a kind of medium speed doesn't work when feel one is completely out of the experience. There's no connection with the walking. I'm not here really walking. I'm just completely distracted, or I'm just dull. Then change the speed. Slower, you may try. Does slower work? Maybe it's worse. Just fall asleep. Then you walk faster and be aware not of maybe rising, moving, and dropping. You know, one may just have been lifting, placing. If one use mental notes in a more simple way. With any experience arising within oneself, there is no way one can push them away. Because it's oneself one is trying to push away, and that does not work. It's by an intimacy of knowing the experience within oneself that the balance of mind to receive them will be cultivated. And when any experience is arising, any state of mind is arising, within a balanced mind is no problem. Nothing is a problem, is our reaction to it which make it difficult. Desire, aversion, doubt, sloth and torpor, agitation, restlessness, when is received within a balanced state of mind, there are never any problem. And they will also change and not last for a long time. Sometimes one may be aware in one's practice, when one gets tired, one comes here and sits, and then one feels it's difficult, I'm getting tired of my meditation. It is usually because one is fighting against something. One comes with an expectation, and then what is arising is not up to the expectation, and then one starts to fight. And that makes the practice difficult and frustrating. In a sense, the balance of mind as an element of serenity. And that could be a way of seeing if the mind is balanced. When there is frustration, it means that I am not, either I am avoiding something or I am expecting something. And that's really some way of making our practice difficult. Expectation and aversion to what's happening. So you may check sometimes. You feel that you are making much effort, and you may check what I am expecting or what am I pushing away. And then relax into the experience. We don't use much thinking. It doesn't mean that it should never be used. Sometimes one or two proper thoughts may just bring some balance and help our practice, especially when we see this attitude of fighting and making the practice difficult. It's so hard, and something is not proper. Everything is already being, everything has been already being done. We are present, we are alive, so we don't need to make ourselves alive. So the main job has been made. So just be here with it. And when we try to make it, that starts to be difficult, to make our being, make our being here. It's not possible, it's already here, it's already done. So see in your practice if you can explore and develop this balance of mind. Not fighting, not pushing away, and no expectation. There may be very much deep peace within any experience, being the most painful sensation, desire, hatred. When it's received within a balanced mind, there may be very much peace within that. I think there is something dramatic in the way we are conducting our life, because we try always, and we try so hard to find serenity and completeness. And this trying is just making it impossible to find it. There is one description of meditation in the Tibetan tradition which is very interesting. If we were just to sit down quietly, not trying to accomplish anything, not being mindful of anything, or not being distracted, I don't say it is easy, then what will arise is usually there will be no thoughts arising anymore. There will be no thoughts. There will be clarity of mind without any object. And then there will be bliss arising. Which means if we were just stopping to try to accomplish something, just relax, bliss will be there. And we are so busy trying to find bliss, can never rise. It's there, but we can't listen to it. Not that we are trying to achieve bliss, is not what I mean, but how we can interfere with our practice, making it more complicated rather than let it happen. So let's be kind with ourselves. Not achieve anything. So there is just a few minutes left for closing our eyes and just quieting the mind.